All right. Well, it's good to be here. You can call me Lewis rather than Dr. Jones. That's okay. Now, I'm glad I'm here today. I'm glad you're here today because what I want to fundamentally talk about today is knowing God and how we know God. I was, however, musing on why I'm the one who happens to be standing here before you today, and I thought, you know, why is it that someone needs to come and give a talk on science and Christianity? And why is it me? Why would that be a good idea? And the answer I came to is, well, it's sort of, I'm a bit of a freak of nature, you know, a bit of a freak of nature, I guess. Yeah, sorry, that's not, I don't mean because I'm American. I just, what I mean is that the reason I'm here today is that I'm a scientist who's also a Christian, right? A scientist who also is a Christian. It's kind of like, I fit in the circus sideshow, you know, sort of there with the bearded lady and the tattooed man. I mean, no one invites a Christian economist to give a talk like this, do they? Or a Christian historian or a Christian English professor to give a talk like this. No one thinks that there's some fundamental conflict between Thomas Hardy's, you know, Far From the Madding Crowd and the fundamental principles of Christianity. But there's something about the presumed conflict between science and Christianity which means that, at least in the eyes of the world, and probably in most of your eyes, I should not exist. I'm a freak of nature. In fact, they should have charged admission to get in today, I guess, is what I'm saying. They didn't actually charge admission, did they? Yeah. How do you know what you know? That's where I want to start. How do you know what you know? No doubt if we asked, if everyone gave an answer to that question, there'd be as many answers as there are people in this room, perhaps. But science, I think we'd have to agree, is, in our culture at least, and in this period of time, the undisputed champion, the dominant player on the field of knowing. And so I want to talk about how we know what we know and try and encourage you to think about then how you might get to know God. So I want to challenge you today about what it means to know God. I'll do that by responding to two challenges that are raised by science to knowing God. Now, I don't think a lot of us actually spend a lot of time thinking about how we know what we know, and perhaps the most common idea about knowing in relation to science and Christianity is that science deals in facts and proofs and certainty, while Christianity deals in faith, or more pejoratively, blind faith, or something like that. We also use the language of proof as a defense against unwanted information often. Don't you, you know how it goes, the conversation, you know, someone tells you something that's kind of surprising and you say, prove it. Or someone tells you something you don't want to hear and you say, prove it. Someone tells you something that you already decided isn't true and you say, prove it. We've all done it. And the thing is, as soon as we start talking about proof, sort of by cultural convention, what we've done is we've raised the bar so high that no one can get over it. We can always demand a little bit better evidence, or a little bit more evidence. They have to prove it, you see, but we get to set the standards of proof. We say prove it, but what we really mean is convince me. Convince me. So there's no objectivity, actually, in the process, because it comes down to the individual. You have to convince me that this piece of information is true. But how does proof relate to the knowledge of God? I want to challenge us to be good scientists today and think objectively about how we know what we know, even if it's just for this short time here together. And I want to submit to you that although there will be a subjective aspect of persuading someone that something is true always, because it will always come down to each individual in the crowd or sitting around the table deciding whether they believe something is true, that there is actually an objective side of that as well. And it operates in such a way that it can give us standards, this objective side of knowing and setting standards of reliability so that we can accept and share these standards of reliability with one another and perhaps increase the consensus around the table. What I want to do then first is start with these two challenges of science that science makes to knowing God. In 1986, Stephen Hawking published a book entitled A Brief History of Time. Catchy title. It describes the search for a unified theory, a theory of everything. And the final paragraph of the book reads as follows. If we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, I guess that's most of us, be able to take part in the discussion of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would truly know the mind of God. So the knowledge of God is scientific knowledge. This is the extraordinary claim that Stephen Hawking made in 1986. Now, in order to grapple with how a scientist who is avowedly anti-Christian can come to that conclusion, we need to understand something of the power of science. So the power of science. The power of science is really found in this mysteriously mathematical nature of our world. One of the greatest minds in physics in the 20th century, Richard Feynman, puts it this way when discussing the rules of nature, or what we might call the laws of physics, and how we check these laws of physics or rules. Incidentally, the fact that there are rules at all to be checked is a kind of miracle. That it is possible to find a rule like the inverse square law of gravitation is some sort of miracle. Or he goes on, the rules that describe nature seem to be mathematical. It is not a characteristic necessity of science that it be mathematical. It just turns out that you can state mathematical laws, in physics at least, which work to make powerful predictions. You see, observations can only ever tell us, on average, what's happened in the past. You run your experiment, and you know what the result of that experiment was for yesterday when you ran the experiment. That's what you find when you make observations and run experiments. Experiments only ever give us these discrete points of data. And all that data tells us is what would happen if we ran precisely the same experiment again. However, our rational minds, and this is what Feynman is picking up on, coupled with the amazing and mysterious fact that the world is mathematical, can take those observations and turn them into powerful predictions about the future. See, if you have data that looks like it lies along a line, you fit a line to the data, and now you can predict the result of any experiment you run. You know one point of data, and you can get the other. You know one input variable, and you can get the other one. But even you still haven't done that experiment. So you're predicting the results of experiments that you haven't ever run. For example, once you know an equation to describe the relationship between altitude and boiling point, for instance, you don't need to go to the top of Mount Everest and run the experiment. You know what the boiling point will be on the top of Mount Everest if you just plug it into your little equation. So science works, and its power to simplify the world around us into these mathematical equations makes it seemingly unstoppable. Seemingly unstoppable. I mean, look at our houses, our microwaves, electric kettles, watches, stereos, videos, computers, cars, buses, trains, airplanes, space stations, our medicine, our communication. It's absolutely fascinating. When my little boy is 2.5 years old now, when he was born, he wasn't breathing. But my wife and I didn't know until a day later that he hadn't been breathing. They had to resuscitate him. Why? Well, because it was such a routine thing for them to get this baby kick-started and working and breathing that they didn't even have to mention it to us. Such a routine thing. Isn't that amazing? And communication. My mother, bless her soul, lives in Huntsville, Alabama. And that's 10,000 miles away from where I'm standing right now. But I can send her an email, tell her what I'm up to, and she can send an email back telling me she misses me or whatever. And it's a matter of a few seconds. It's a matter of a few seconds. Isn't that incredible? And that is because of this amazing power of science to make predictions about our world, because of this mathematical reliability. We're trained from birth by our very environment to enjoy, to need, to love, and expect the success of science. The power of science has led to a confidence that not only will all questions be answered, but that they will be answered by science. And that's where we get to these two challenges that I want to bring before us today. The first one is materialism. And the idea that all questions will be answered by science has arisen from a confusion of the ground rules of science. The primary ground rule is that all observable phenomena have a natural cause. This means that the answer will always be found within the kind of world of matter and energy, things we can poke and sort of stick a thermometer into and so on. So the assumption that science has made in its founding principles is that as we go and look at the world will be intelligible and understandable to us on its own terms, and that we do not need to look beyond the world of matter and energy to explain and understand how the various phenomena work and why they operate the way that they operate. So even though the original first scientists were Christians, they knew that if they always invoked God as the explanation for everything that they found in nature, that they would never actually get an explanation that would help them understand the world around them. And so they said, no, what we'll do is we will decide beforehand that we will refuse to invoke God as an explanation for the phenomena we observe in the world. And we'll confine our explanations to matter and energy, the stuff that you can measure and touch and feel and see, and so on. And this convenient methodological decision is referred to as materialism. So materialism is the doctrine that whatever exists is either physical matter or depends upon physical matter. Now, in the case of science, originally, it was just a convenient assumption that they used to get on with the business of doing their work. But using materialism as a methodology, scientists have discovered that as we persevere, the natural world really does yield up answers to us about how things work. The assumption actually works. We can find out answers from the matter and energy around us. And because that methodology has worked so well, scientists have decided that the methodology is, in fact, the truth about the world. So the methodology has become an ideology. And that is, science now operates on the belief, not just the convenient assumption or the methodology, but the belief that all that exists is matter and energy. There is no spiritual world, no angels or demons, no God. And this constitutes the first challenge to knowing God from science. The spiritual world, and therefore God, does not exist. So the challenge, I guess, being that if God doesn't exist, you can't know him. Now, the first challenge, materialism, flows directly into the second, which is that as a discipline responsible for investigating the world of matter and energy, that is the only stuff left to investigate. If that's the only stuff that exists, that's the only stuff left to investigate, and therefore the discipline which investigates that stuff, the matter and energy, the natural world, is the discipline which has the only knowledge worth knowing. If that's all there is, then that's the only knowledge worth knowing. And this is a way of looking at the world known as scientism. And scientism is the conviction that scientific knowledge, particularly that derived from the natural sciences, is the highest or even only form of knowledge. And you can see that scientists themselves have sort of jumped on this bandwagon as they talk about science to us, the public. Science offers a surer path to God than religion. What an odd thing to say. I mean, what is religion, after all, other than a path to God? Where science has actually advanced to the point where what were formerly religious questions can be seriously tackled. And you can't pass Albert Einstein. Serious scientific workers are the only profoundly religious people. So if all knowledge is scientific knowledge, that is how Stephen Hawking can make the claim that even knowledge of God must come from science. He doesn't believe in God, and yet he is confident that any information about God worth having will come from science. This constitutes the second challenge to knowing God from science. Science is the only valid form of knowledge. And under the current mood of scientism, then, even if God does exist, even if this materialistic assumption is wrong, the power and effectiveness of science has so swept all competitors from the field, all of the knowledge seems weak and unreliable, and knowledge of God seems impossible, except perhaps the knowledge of what God has made. So there's no access to the person of God, no personal relationship available. Okay, now let me first briefly respond to the first challenge, that of materialism, before spending the rest of the time actually going into scientism and how we can respond to that. The move from methodological materialism to ideological materialism is a serious confusion of categories, isn't it? When one's methodology confines investigation to the world of matter and energy, one ought to confine one's pronouncements to the world of matter and energy. There is no logical license for moving from the methodology into an ideology. There is no discovery, no theory, no speculation which can give any grounds for making that move. Now, as a discipline, however, science has made that move. And so the question is, now, can we bring anything to bear on that situation? And in fact, we can. Because people throughout time have, in fact, advanced evidence for the existence of some kind of God from observing nature. Even Aristotle, who was neither Jewish nor Christian, lived around sort of 300s BC, saw from the very way nature worked, that from the laws of cause and effect, that there must be a prime mover, the unmoved mover, or the uncaused cause. And his argument has been subsumed into a more general sort of constellation of, of arguments known as cosmological arguments, and there are great subtleties over which I will pass in the interest of time. However, these arguments are still in use today, still wielding force and power even among non-Christian scientists. So Paul Davies again says this: this so-called cosmological argument has in one form or another often been used as evidence for the existence of God. The enigma of the cosmic origin is probably the one area where the atheistic scientist will feel uncomfortable. And he's one of those atheistic scientists. Now, John Wheeler, a gravitational theorist, perhaps feeling a little uncomfortable, says, science must provide a mechanism for the universe to come into being. And Davies finishes what he is saying by saying that the conclusion of the cosmological argument, that God exists, would be hard to fault unless we can explain the origin of the cosmos from within the framework of physics. Now, another argument for the existence of God from the realm of scientific knowledge comes under the heading of intelligent design. I'm not going to talk much about that, just to simply say that it's the idea that when you look around, the world looks like it was made this way by some intelligence, that it was designed. Rather than looking natural, it looks unnatural. It looks like a watch lying in a field, according to William Paley, rather than a rock lying in a field full of rocks. So now, even if we rightly reject the move of materialism from methodology to ideology and emphatically declare that there's a spiritual world out there, how are we going to learn anything about the spiritual world if the only form of knowledge is science, the only kind of knowledge which can investigate the world of matter and energy? So must we concede that even though God exists, let's say, we have no way of knowing him? Well, as we attempt to respond to this challenge, we're going to look at three issues. One is the difference between proof and certainty, proof or certainty and reliability, proof and reliability. And two, how different fields of knowledge measure reliability. And three, how a relationship with God is different from knowing information about God. So like I said, I want to talk to us about knowing God. We'll get there in the end. But first, I want to answer this challenge of scientism. So are there different types of knowledge? Is science the only thing we've got? No. There are different ways of knowing. And I've picked out four to discuss today, but you can imagine others, I'm sure. And what we'll do is we'll look at rational knowledge, or kind of mathematical knowledge, scientific knowledge, historical knowledge, and personal knowledge. And the first two will help us understand this difference between certainty and reliability, or proof and reliability. So rational knowledge, okay, and like I said, maybe mathematical knowledge is a better way of saying it. That is, this kind of knowledge is knowledge that arises from working within a closed system of objects and rules and operations. Geometry is a good example of that. And I can prove to you, for instance, within the rules of geometry, that the three inscribed angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees. You reckon I can do it? Let's see what we can do here. There's a triangle, okay? And we've got alpha, beta, and gamma there. Now, if you're not, like, don't worry about it, okay? But we'll see how we go. Okay, alpha, beta, and gamma, we've got three angles in the triangle. Okay, now we've got a line segment there and a line segment there. A couple other angles defined there. Okay, and so now the thing is that any line segment, right, is the diameter of a circle. Any line segment is the diameter of a circle, which means it sweeps out 180 degrees. Right, so from over here, line crossed back over here, that's 180 degrees, half a circle. Right, okay, so what we can say is then that A1 plus alpha plus A2 is equal to 180 degrees, right? Because there are three angles that fall along a straight line like that. Now we've got our parallel lines there, A and B, around the triangle. And because these lines are parallel, we've got beta equal to A1 because they're flip side of that same line, and gamma equal to A2. And very simply then, if you substitute in for A1 and A2, you get alpha, beta, and gamma equal to 180 degrees. Ta-da! See, right? Very simple. Very simple. You all learned this in high school and still think about it every day of your lives, I'm sure. But there you have it. And that is truth. That is certainty. That is a proof. Right? You used to construct proofs in geometry, didn't you? And it is a certain piece of knowledge. Given the rules of the game, there are no grounds on which to dispute that truth. Okay, so it's a certain piece of knowledge. That's what this kind of rational knowledge gives us, is this certain kind of knowledge. All right. Now, but let's compare that with scientific knowledge. What is scientific knowledge doing for us? Okay, now knowledge gained from the scientific enterprise is primarily founded on repeatability. So the sun rose yesterday, it rose today, rose maybe the day before that, and so on, and so on, and so on. So every night before going to bed, it would be quite reasonable to say to yourself, on average, in the past, the sun has risen about 12 hours after it set, and I predict it will do so again tomorrow. Right? That's a perfectly reasonable prediction from within science. So we use the observation of the repetition of particular events to generalize about the way the world works in a more universal kind of way. And we make predictions based on these kind of repeated successes in the lab. But now, take our triangle from before, okay? The scientific method for determining whether it's true for all triangles that the three inscribed angles add up to 180 degrees would be to measure the inscribed angles of a triangle, and then measure the angles of another one, and another one, and another one. And after a while, finding that they always add up to 180 degrees, you might decide you've done enough work to make a prediction. And your prediction, presumably, would be that the three inscribed angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. But what we need to clarify in our language is that you haven't proven anything in the sense that you've proven something in that kind of rational or mathematical, geometrical way. The only thing that you can ever prove using the scientific method, and you're familiar with this idea, is that your theory is wrong, right? Not that it's right. You're always one observation away from proving your theory wrong. There are more triangles to be measured, and if you measure all the ones that you can find, I can draw another one on a piece of paper for you to measure. You'll never know if the next triangle is going to fit your prediction. You cannot know. And the thing is, science constitutes a fundamentally different way of knowing than our rational knowledge. So in science, reliable information is information which is derived from repeatable observations. Proof is not the issue. Proof is about certainty. Scientific knowledge is about reliability. Okay? So that's the first thing I want to get us to understand, is this distinction between the kind of certainty of this rational game-based knowledge with rules that we make up and investigating the natural world around us. The natural world isn't as kind as the rational world. Now, science is always only one observation away from disproving any theory, hypothesis, law, or whatever. It's not about certainty, but about reliability. Now, the thing is, in our comparison of certainty and reliability, we've seen that knowledge of the way our world works is fundamentally uncertain. And yet, it is reliable information, right? I mean, I would just list all these houses, cars, microwaves. It's reliable information. These things work. They keep working. They keep working. Science keeps working. It's reliable information. It's reliable to the point that I will get in a plane for 14 hours and fly out over the Pacific Ocean to go home. I mean, that's how reliable I think it is. We live our lives assuming the reliability of this kind of information. We trust it. We trust this kind of information enough to go to the top of Sydney Tower and lean against the glass as we look down on the city below, don't we? Well, maybe not all of us do, but I think most of us probably do. Most of us probably do. Okay, so that's the comparison between certainty and reliability. Now, to tackle the second issue, we'll turn to consider the third and fourth types of knowledge, historical and personal knowledge, and look at them all then together. So first of all, history. How do you know that World War I happened? Someone told you, presumably. Do you believe them? Do you believe them? Why do you believe them? When it comes to history, we're dealing with, yet again, a different way of knowing something. So how do we know that a piece of information like World War I happened is reliable? How can you prove it? To use our hopefully discarded now language of proof. Have scientists gone to the lab and reproduced the conditions under which World War I started, and then they re-ran the experiment? Having been successful, they kind of thought, okay, we'll rerun that a few times to make sure we got it right. Historical events are, by definition, non-repeatable events. Historical events are not accessible to scientific investigation. Scientific knowledge is based on repeatability, and history is all about singular events. Okay, so the question then comes, what are the measures of historical reliability? And primarily, reliability is based on the sources of your information. That's simple, makes sense. Based on your sources, what kind of sources? Well, you might want to know the distance of a source from an event that they're describing, the distance in time. So if they lived around the same time, you might think the information is more reliable, or even distance in geography. If they're other side of the world, you might think that their information about a particular event wasn't as reliable. You might weigh up the number of sources that you have and whether they're independent sources and how much new information you get from each of the different sources. Does the new information actually fit with the bigger picture of what you know? Also, of course, there's bias of sources writing. Anyone can write anything they like. I mean, just look on the internet, you know. You can find anyone who will say anything about anything. And you don't have to look that long. Google is a wonderful thing. But the question about bias is, does the source have a vested interest in what they're talking about? You might think that mediates or moderates the reliability a bit of the information. So these are some of the various things that historians consider as they decide on the reliability of historical information. I'm not a historian, so I submit that hopefully helpful and hopefully not misleading, but I don't think it is. The important thing to note here is that when an historian's deliberations are completed and they make a pronouncement about whether or not some event happened and how it happened, it's taken to be true. It's taken to be reliable information. It becomes a piece of knowledge in the annals of history. Is it certain? No. Is it scientific? No. Is it reliable? Yes. It's reliable. It's history. And just as scientists are allowed to make pronouncements about when they think they've collected enough data to be confident of a pattern, so we must let historians make pronouncements about the events they study, and we must take their word for it. We can investigate it ourselves, same way we could do in science. But they haven't proven anything either in that language of proof. But according to the way they test information, it is reliable. So different fields of knowledge, different ways of knowing. The information can and ought to still be classified as reliable, even though it's historical, not science. Okay. So now, if we employ these objective standards, like I mentioned at the beginning, of reliability in our own thinking about how we know what we know, we can have a common ground for evaluating the truth or reliability of knowledge. And at the same time, all sorts of knowledge will be put on the table for consideration. And, you know, we're at a Christian meeting, cutting to the chase, what about the resurrection of Jesus, for instance? Do you realize that according to the measures of history, the resurrection of Jesus is as much an historical event as the various battles of Julius Caesar? In fact, really, I mean, according to the sources, the resurrection is on firmer ground. There are far more sources closer to the time, better attested, that Jesus rose from the dead than that Julius Caesar even ever existed, except for archaeological evidence. So let me say this to you then. You live in a world where a man has risen from the dead. Does that change the way you look at the world? It's worth considering. Maybe you don't believe it happened. Maybe you think science tells us that people don't rise from the dead. In fact, though, what science tells us is that on average in the past, people haven't risen from the dead. And science makes the reasonable prediction that people will not rise from the dead in the future. But what science can't tell you is whether anyone has ever risen from the dead. Someone rising from the dead. Now that is a surprising piece of information. And science can neither explain nor deny it, but history can confirm it. And it certainly suggests that there is something more to this world than matter and energy. It suggests there's something beyond death. The resurrection of Jesus is a non-repeatable event, which cannot be investigated by science, but must be reckoned with historically. Now if you find it difficult to believe, read one or two of the Gospels. And see what you think. Read what other historians have written about it, Christian and non-Christian. But don't write it off because it's not scientific. Most of what you know of the world is not scientific. Which takes me to the next kind of information, which is personal information. And personal information encompasses that sort of information pertaining to persons. It may be intuitive sort of information. It's information which is largely designed to serve relationships, isn't it? This kind of personal information. So the promise to meet a friend at somewhere at a given time, that's kind of information. Or knowing that I love my wife, that's information that I carry with me. Or knowing that you enjoy the cricket. Do you enjoy the cricket? I'm sure the vast majority of you do, and believe it or not, this American standing before you today enjoys the cricket. And I think I even understand it as well. Now, if you don't enjoy the cricket, I'm going to carry on about this for a while, so substitute something in that you do enjoy so that the point isn't lost, okay? Now, are you sure that you enjoy the cricket? Are you sure? I mean, how do you know you enjoy the cricket? Now, before you switch on the telly every time to watch, do you try and remember back to every time before you've watched and sort of kind of build up the evidence for the fact that, oh yeah, I do enjoy the cricket, I think I'll turn on the television. No, you just know it. You know you enjoy the cricket. Now, is that knowledge more or less reliable than the prediction that the sun will rise tomorrow? is that strange to hear it in that sort of context? Is that knowledge more or less reliable than the claim that World War I occurred? If you were going to lay a bet on one, would you pick the sun rising tomorrow? Would you pick the fact that World War I occurred? Or would you pick that you enjoy the cricket? How would you choose? How could you choose between those different pieces of information? Which one's more reliable? They are at least equally reliable pieces of information, and yet you have arrived at them knowing them in three different ways. Okay, let's turn personal knowledge around another way. I'll tell you something. I love A1 steak sauce. Well, yeah, you don't know what A1 steak sauce is. It's this fabulous steak sauce that you can only get in America. But I actually have some in my refrigerator at home. I've had it specially imported in various people's luggage. Now, I love A1 steak sauce, but do you believe me? Do you believe me when I tell you that? Why do you believe me? The only access you have to that piece of information and its reliability is me and what you know of me. You might ask yourself, do I have a reason to lie about steak sauce? Do I have access to the information in order to be able to truly tell you the information? Do you think that I understand what I'm talking about so that you can trust kind of my communication of the information? See, it's different from science and it's different from history. But in this case, your confidence in the piece of information is entirely dependent on what you know about me and what you think about me. And that may seem a rather flimsy confidence on the face of it, but consider that this is the basis on which we conduct all of our relationships. Right? Our close relationships, family, friends, etc., our structural kind of relationships, bosses, teachers, and so on. Our casual relationships, shop owners, administrative staff here at the uni, sporting teams, fellow students, people on the bus or the train. All of our relationships, all of human society, functions on the basis of the reliability of this personal kind of knowledge. I mean, we count our change at the supermarket, well, some of us do, but we don't really expect it to be wrong. We trust the bus driver to obey the traffic rules most of the time and at least get us home safely. We trust the admin staff in the school to kind of process our marks properly. We trust our lecturers to teach us the truth. We don't spend our lives second-guessing everyone we meet. If we did, we'd never get anything accomplished, and we'd offend everyone in the process. When a friend says, "I'll meet you on the ground floor of the Wentworth Building at 3 p.m. today," what do you do? Do you turn up at 2 and then leave at 2:05 in disgust? Do you turn up the next day? Do you wait on the first floor instead? Of course not. See, we live by and act on this kind of information in thousands of ways every day. We treat it as reliable information. We need to understand and trust these standards of reliability, which are natural to an area of knowledge in order to operate in the world. Is scientific knowledge the only valid form of knowledge? No. There are any number of other sources of reliable knowledge. So we've looked at rational, historical, personal knowledge, and science. And we've seen how knowledge acquired in different areas requires different means of evaluation. But now the third issue we wanted to tackle was knowing God. Knowing God. So we've looked at comparison of certainty and reliability. We've looked at the different kinds of knowledge and the ways of knowing things and different knowledge. And now I want to finish with talking about knowing God. So what is a relationship with God like? Well, see, in fact, even asking the question that way, using the word relationship, puts the issue in a different realm to knowing the mind of God, as per Stephen Hawking. So for Christians, knowing God is having a relationship with him, a genuine personal relationship. Now, how is that different from what Hawking was suggesting? He's claiming that we will know God through science. So through our examination of the matter and energy of this universe, we come to know God. But that is like saying that you could know me by examining the birdhouse I made in year 7 industrial arts. You can certainly pick up a few things about me. I probably didn't care that much about it. That birdhouse, man, it hung in my backyard on the apple tree for years and years and years. I might not have cared that much. The lines aren't all that straight. The hole's too big. The hook isn't really at the center of gravity sort of thing, so it kind of, you know, the poor little birds. Perhaps you just look, maybe what you learn is I'm just not perfect, you know? Maybe that's what you'd find out about me. But would that kind of information be sufficient to sustain a deep, personal, long-term relationship with me? I mean, to examine my birdhouse is not the same thing as having a relationship with me, even though you could learn a few things about me. Maybe. Maybe I was just having a bad day. What about if you're throwing a birthday party for your mother? Would you invite the butcher on the corner? I mean, the butcher knows how many kilos of scotch fillet or sausages she buys every week, but he doesn't know her. He doesn't have a relationship with her. You wouldn't invite him to her birthday party. What about the postman? The postman knows where all your mother's mail comes from. Probably knows the names of a few of your relatives. But you wouldn't invite him to her birthday party. So if God were throwing a birthday party for Jesus, would he invite you? Knowing God is not about looking at how the birdhouse is put together. It's about loving and laughing and weeping and spending time with the person who made the birdhouse. God is not primarily concerned about how interested we are, how fascinated we are with, how committed we are to the world that he made. God made us a relationship with him. But that relationship is not based on what you can find out about God from investigating the creation through the means of science, nor is it based on what you might deduce from God and his world from the sort of naked events of history. It's a relationship based on the coming together of two persons, two individuals, and the give and take and the to and fro of conversation, the building of trust through promises made, promises kept. It's like a relationship you have with a friend or a parent or a brother or a sister. How do you get to know God? Ask yourself how you get to know anyone. They have to give themselves to you. They have to talk and reveal themselves to you, and you have to respond by doing the same with yourself. It's the same with God. In the pages of the Bible, the Christian scriptures, God has given himself for you. He has revealed everything about himself which will be useful in getting to know him. And that's what the Bible is. It's God introducing himself to us. You can decide what you think of the reliability of the knowledge you find in the Bible as you get to know the God who is speaking to you, as you get to know the God about whom that information pertains. So let me challenge you as I finish. Take time to hear what God wants to tell you about himself and get to know in this personal sort of way, not scientific, not historical, not rational, but in this personal way, get to know the joy and the freedom of relationship with him. Thanks.